Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, welcome to Blog Talk Radio, the Juror 13 show. And my name is Denny Griffin. For the next hour, I'll be your host. And tonight we're going to be discussing interviewing and interrogation. And our guest for the show this evening is Don Howell. And Don graduated with honors with a degree in Police Science Administration. He spent 25 years as an officer for two different agencies in Southern California cities. He retired from the Huntington Beach Police Department. As a detective for more than 15 years, he specialized in the investigation of sexual assaults and child abuse. He's a court-certified expert in these areas and is a highly sought-after consultant to agencies on complex cases. As a consultant to the California Commission on Peace Officer Standards and Training, also known as POST, Don was considered to be one of the best in his field and was selected to assist and making a telefront conference course on rape investigations. And Don actually authored a couple of books regarding interviewing and interrogations, which he combined into a book titled Sex Crime Interviews Simplified. Don, welcome to the Juror 13 show.
Well, thank you, Dan. I'm glad to be here.
And you are actually now, I believe you corrected me previously, you're not fully retired, you are semi-retired.
That's correct. I actually did my 30 years and then retired about 6 years ago, and they hired me back to work part-time. I still do some sexually motivated crimes and some cold case homicides now, but I only work a couple days a week.
How many days?
Two a week if I can, you know, can't get out of it, you know.
Okay.
Right. Wait, nobody should have to work more than 2 days a week unless you really have to, you know?
I agree with that wholeheartedly. I was telling you before we went on the air that one of the areas I wanted to get into and one of the reasons I was really excited to have you on as a guest is we've been doing a series of shows about crimes against children. We refer to the programs as Children Under Siege. And there are certainly no lack of these crimes against children.
Right.
So some involve apparent sexual abuse or whatever, some don't. But what I wanted to do is talk about your experience and expertise in interviewing child victims of abuse, sexual abuse, and to start with, and if you could tell us how you go about when you have a 3-, 4-, 5-year-old, maybe child who is an alleged victim of some type of sexual assault, how difficult an interview is that?
Actually, it's not as hard as most people would think. The younger the child, as long as they're verbal, you know, they're like 4, 5, 6, 7, something like that, they really kind of accept the world as it is presented to them. And so if you just approach them with, hi, I'm here to talk to you about something, we draw little stick figures and we trace hands and we just get talking to them for a little bit. And keep in mind that their attention span is real small, so you can't interview them for like an hour or two or three. You know, they just can't pay attention that long. And you just talk to them like you talk to your grandkids, or if you're that old, like I am old enough to have grandkids, you know. It actually goes pretty quickly. The issue we have with the in-family stuff is that a lot of the molesting is what's referred to as quote-unquote, you know, simple fondling, where the child's body has not been injured. And so with that, they really don't understand that the touching was sexual, so you got to sort of sneak up on that subject matter. If they've actually been kidnapped or, you know, a raped kind of a thing, then obviously you can talk about that one event real easily by saying, hey, just tell me what happened last night, or when you say you recovered the kid a few hours later, that kind of thing. And again, they're really pretty upfront with it. It's sort of like taking them to the doctor. You just got to say, put on your doctor face and say, tell me what happened, you know.
The family, I assume, or the child's family is involved in the interview process?
Well, correct. What I like to do, and my way is disputed by some people, I like to have either mom or dad in the interview when I talk to the child. It's like their security blanket, you know. And if you think about it, if you take your 4-year-old to the doctor, you know, mom's not going to stay out in the waiting room while the kid's being examined. They're going to be there with them, and the kid expects the parent to be there. And the kid can help, or the parent can help interpret what the child is saying for you. You know, if they use different words for their body parts, they call their vaginal area their Twinkie or something such as that. You know, mom can interpret those phrases for you. You know, and so I like having mom or dad involved, physically present there. Some people think differently. You should take mom and dad out, but to me, I've always been real successful with having them there, assuming they're not the suspect. You know.
Do parents ever interfere, do you think? Ever probably is a little too broad, but how frequent is it where you would find a parent to be a liability rather than an asset?
Oh, probably 15-20% of the time. What you have is there's two different, if you're talking about an ongoing molest, okay, that's gone on more than just one time by a stranger, you're talking about, you know, an uncle or a stepbrother or the neighbor man or something like that. What you have is a real complex relationship between the child and the suspect, which usually develops for one of two reasons. Usually the parents are completely unplugged from the child, and they may be physically present, but they're workaholic, alcoholics, you know, divorced, separated, whatever. They're too busy to spend time with the child. And so the child seeks out someone that will pay attention to them, and then the child realizes that the price for this attention is to allow the sexual touching. And so these molests will go on for quite a while, and then when they're finally discovered, the kid's reluctant to talk about it because they have some positive feelings towards the offender. Plus, they know that the first question is going to be, why didn't you tell us the first time the guy touched you? Okay, and so they're really kind of reluctant to talk about that. Now, the issue with the parents, of course, is that they're so unplugged, they just want the whole thing to go away. And they're the ones who don't show up for interviews. They don't bring the kids in for medical exams. They don't go into therapy. They just rather the whole thing go away because they're just too busy to deal with the issue. And so those parents are liabilities in the sense they won't bring them to you. Or they've downplayed it so much they've basically told the kid, don't talk to the cops, you know, and just kind of pretend like the whole thing never happened. And that's the greater liability on most of the ongoing interviews or ongoing scenarios.
Is that something that can be overcome or usually overcome, or is that kind of the death knell for the...
What I try to do, if I see that developing, if I see what I would call a pipeline case developing, where, you know, the offender's put himself in a position to attract a lot of potential victims to himself, such as, you know, he's an athletic coach or whatever, and then he's found a few children that are vulnerable to being molested. It's real difficult for those kids to give up the molester during the time that they're in the pipeline. So what I'll try to do is I'll try to get the kids at school so that mom and dad cannot interfere. If you ask their permission, they'll usually deny, they'll stumble around, they'll make an appointment and never show up. You want to grab the kid at what is usually a safe environment for them, and where they're used to talking to adults. And so you'll even postpone the interview. Say you think the kid's being molested, you find out about it on a Friday. I've waited till Monday or Tuesday to get the kid at school, even though they still may be at risk over the weekend. But it's better to get them to talk to you than to deny when they're with mom and dad. And so you try to find them a neutral ground if you can.
So even a couple of days delay may end up with a successful interview and so forth.
Right.
Where
right.
The other way could jeopardize it.
Correct, and it's a difficult decision to make, you know, knowing that the child still may be at risk, especially if it's stepdad who's the offender, or, you know, an uncle or a half-brother, you know, whatever, stepbrother situation or whatever. It's a tough call to make, but if you look at long-term resolution, you kind of have to go in favor of let's wait till and get the kid in an environment where they're likely to talk.
And if the parents impede the investigation in the form of not cooperating, not bringing the child to interview sessions and so forth, can they be charged with anything? Is there any recourse, or is that
not in California that I'm aware of? They're really not interfering with the investigation. You know, we really need the parents on our side because they have to bring the kid to court. You know, we can't subpoena a 4-year-old to court, but we can subpoena the parents to bring the child in. And so they would be in contempt if he got into a courtroom situation. But if they just plain don't show up, boy, you really just can't go out and arrest them. You know, you can call them as much as you want and, you know, try to make life miserable for them to bring them in. But if they're not going to be there to support the child and be active parents and say it's okay to talk and all that kind of stuff, it's going to be a tough one to get the kid to talk to you. And it's not a whole lot we can do about it, to be quite honest with you.
Okay, just to hold on just a second, Dan. I think... our other panelist might be on the line. Dr. Jan, is that you?
Yes, I'm here.
Hi, how are you tonight, Doc?
I'm good.
Hey, Doc, say hello to Don Howell.
Hi, Don.
Hi, Dr. Jan, how are you?
I'm good.
All right, cool.
You may have heard us. We've just been discussing a little bit about interviewing child victims of sexual abuse and dealing with the parents and so on and so forth. And if anybody else has a question or comment for Don or Dr. Jan, you can reach us at 646-478-0982. 646-478-0982. You were saying earlier, Don, that when you have a fondling situation where the child's body is not injured or not hurt,
right.
And then, of course, you have the other scenario where there is physical evidence that something has happened. So a medical exam in those cases, obviously, to document in a timely manner what happened, that's also critical to the case. Is that a fair assumption?
Oh, absolutely. Even if you have a situation where the kid is telling you that there was just over-the-clothes fondling, you always want to have the medical exam to confirm that there is no physical evidence, or perhaps the child hasn't told you everything and you may find some, you know, medical evidence or some thickening of the hymenal ring or whatever that would show that there was a more ongoing or chronic kind of abuse going on. Now, if that happens, then, of course, you re-interview the kid and ask him, you know, what's going on, you know. But I've had cases where, you know, the kid's 10, 11 years old, and Dr. Janice probably had this also, and they're 6 months pregnant, and they think they have a tumor, and
mm-hmm.
the tumor has a heartbeat, you know, and they go, I don't know how I got pregnant. It's one of those immaculate conception cases, you know. And it takes a lot of interviewing over a lot of time to get them to finally fess up that it's been dad or stepdad or the neighbor guy or whatever that's got them pregnant. So, like Dr. Jan has to look for things like sexually transmitted diseases and, you know, all the other physical stuff they look for at the colposcope to either confirm a greater molest in what the kid's telling us or to an absence of evidence also confirms what the kid is saying if it's only been over the clothes fondling. Is that correct? Would you go along with that, Dr. Jan?
Yes, I do. And it also depending on, of course, the age of the child that we have this. I kind of like to ask the child myself in a nice environment. You know, I will have music or bubbles or whatever. Like I said, depending on the age. And then I will ask them, you know, why are you here today? And I will see if they kind of tell me the same answer as the reason that they're supposed to be here. Hello?
Yes, correct.
I'm sorry. My phone died, I thought.
Okay. No, you're there.
And then after that, I will examine them. I will make sure I will get their history. I will find out if it's obviously a younger child, if they were potty trained and all of a sudden they stopped potty training or anything of that nature. Then I will look for the redness and if they're having any painful urination or anything like that, and go from there. The girls that come in that are pregnant, obviously, then we have to do a whole slew of testing. We'll do the STDs, blood and cervical, and then, get the ultrasound to find out how far along they are and all that. We go from there.
Right, and with boy victims, it's more difficult because obviously there's very little genitalia findings unless you're looking at anal tears or something such as that. So that makes your exam a little more difficult, I would think.
Yeah, but you can tell, if there is because of the, redness that shouldn't be there. There'll be like petechiae, be more like of a sunburn color type stuff if there was severe touching going on, and we look for discharge and stuff like that.
Yeah, I agree. What the issue is we find those cases where we do have physical evidence, like Dr. Jan's talking about.
Hello?
There are so many others where we don't, and it makes them more difficult
Hello?
To prosecute.
Yeah,
Dr.
you're
I can still hear you.
Yeah, you're on.
I'm just cutting in and out. I'm sorry.
Okay. Don, let's assume now that we're sticking with children for the moment.
Okay.
Let's assume that the police are informed that there's an alleged molestation or abuse. You interview, or the officer interviews the child and gets the information. The child is examined, and the examination, let's say that there was more than fondling. There was more to it than that, and the medical exam confirms what the child said.
Right.
And you've got the parents have cooperated, and everything's going smooth. So the case proceeds then. You would then, or the investigating detective would then at some point want to talk to the suspect, I assume, identify, and then interview the suspect. When the suspect is brought in for the initial interview, is there any special standard thing you would do as the handling detective? Would it depend on the individual and what you, you know, the background you've done on the individual? Or is there kind of a standard thing in all cases where they're handled the same way?
Well, not really. What I do, I take it back a step further, and I look at what the child is telling us about the behavior. Was this a one-time sort of a hit-and-run molest? Was it an ongoing scenario over, you know, a couple of years? Do we have a true pedophile kind of relationship, which pedophilia is really rare? What you have is, even an in-family molest, is actually a rapist who is just, behaviorally is a rapist, who is just assaulting the same victim over and over and over again. And so based on what the child tells you behaviorally, what the dialogue is, and, you know, there's a whole bunch of stuff that goes on, you have an idea of what type of sex offender you're dealing with. And once you do that, you set up the scenario based on his behavior to try to use his behavior against him. A lot of these guys don't do real well with authority confrontations, so talking to them over the phone is oftentimes pretty easy. You know, it's easier for them when they don't have to do face-to-face. Again, it depends on the feel you get for the guy based on what the family's telling you, the parents telling you, you know, or whoever it is that actually knows him. And, of course, if he's been in prison before, you know, it's going to be tough to get him in to talk to you, you know. But once you sit down with the guy, so you do get him in to talk to you, you want to set up an interview style where you allow him to win. These guys are real narcissistic. They need to be in control. They need to have power over you. And so you let them explain away what happened, explain away how this relationship developed with this child, explain away that the parents aren't involved, as involved as they should be, and therefore the child seduced them. You set it up, depending on what type of sex offender you think you're dealing with, you try to use his behavior against him. And that's the to me has been the most successful way of dealing with these kind of guys.
Depending on the nature, you know, and how serious this is. Like, let's suppose it's not an acquaintance or family friend type thing; it's a stranger.
Okay.
A rape. Okay.
Uh-huh.
And especially if you're dealing with somebody with priors for the same thing, you know, out on parole or what have you.
Right.
Do you find it difficult sometimes if they've done some real hideous stuff? Not that any of this is good, but there are varying degrees. You find it tough to not show emotion when you're doing the interview?
Not really. You know, I've been doing this a long, long time. It's been 36 years. I've been on the job now, you know. And so it becomes a challenge to get the guy to cop out to you. Like dealing with murderers or whoever, you know, you just need to take care of business and not take it personal. There are some times when the crimes are so hideous that it turns your stomach, you know. But you just have to force yourself to put that aside and sit down and talk with the guy, knowing that if you don't get the cop out, or you don't get some sort of admission, then the guy might walk and do it again, you know. And so the greater good is to set your emotions aside for a while and do what you have to do. And then later on, you call your own kids, you call whatever, you know, you talk to somebody so you can sort of work it out. You know, you want to make sure that your kids are fine and safe afterwards, and that makes you feel better after the interview's done. But it's all business with us, you know, and then we'll crank them out at a rate of 20 a month. You know,
really?
We're just bringing them in and interviewing them and just, you know, arresting one, and the next day you got another one. It's like catching fish, you know, and bring them in. And you get really good with it. You know, I'll run 20 cases a month, and my partner will do the same thing. And we're just hooking them and reeling them as fast as we can. And so you don't have a time, you know, a lot of time to get really caught up in the emotions of it, you know.
Dr. Jayan, before you got on with us, we were talking about the parents of these abuse victims, child abuse victims, child sexual abuse, and that I believe Don said about probably 20% of the time the parents are not cooperative or fully cooperative in getting the child to interviews and so on and so forth. From the medical standpoint, do you ever encounter problems with the parents as far as the doing the exam and so forth go, or do they pretty much let you do what you're supposed to do?
They usually pretty much let me do what I'm supposed to do. But I have come across some parents who think that what I'm doing is very invasive, and I try to explain to them that what I'm doing is not as invasive as what they went through, and it's actually for the good. It depends on, you know, if it's usually the mothers that are more apprehensive of these cases that are very hysterical, and sometimes I have to ask them to switch out and let somebody else be in the room with me other than them, because sometimes they just make the situation worse for me to examine the child. Because when the mother's upset, then the child gets upset, and then I can't do my job.
Do you ever have a parent argue with your findings or challenge you or something or say, no, that can't be possible? You know, Uncle Ned would never have done that. You must be mistaken.
I never, ever, when I'm doing an exam, I never tell the mother or anybody that's in the room what I find until I'm done.
Okay.
And then I will go sit down with them, because if I have that confrontation while I'm doing it, then it just makes it worse, and then they can stop the whole exam, and I'll never get to find out the findings. So I wait till I'm completely finished, and then I will have the police officer who brought the child in, or CPS or whatever, sit down with me, and I'll explain it to whoever, and then go from there. But I never do it while I'm examining.
Okay, understand. Don, let's go back, if we could, to the suspect interview.
Sure.
We were talking earlier before the show that initial interview certainly can be critical, especially before the suspect has opts for the lawyer.
Correct, yeah.
And like you were saying, you know, one bite at the apple and so forth. When you're talking to the suspect,
right?
Generally speaking, do you find the majority of them are willing to go a little way with you before they want the lawyer, or most of them, you know, as soon as they walk in the room, they want to make a call?
Yeah, if they're gonna like drive themselves down to the police department, you know, they're gonna talk to you. You know, that's pretty much a given. These guys like to talk, and again, there's no absolutes. Obviously, in our business, we know that there's no absolutes when you're dealing with law enforcement stuff. But a lot of these guys love to talk, and you have if you've been on the job for any length of time at all, you kind of get a feel for the ones you can get past Miranda, or which ones you're going to do outside of Miranda interview or whatever, because they like to explain themselves. They're real egotistical. They like to be around law enforcement. I always introduce myself as the lead investigator. You know, you're never the run-of-the-mill new guy on the block investigator. You want to be the head guy, you know, that boosts their ego a little bit, you know. And then you start a conversation with them and say, hey, I need to figure out what's really going on here, as opposed to being real accusatory. And I watch some of the TV shows where they pound their fists on the table and they yell and scream at guys, and all of a sudden they just confess. That don't work. That ain't going to work with these guys. They'll just say, bye, I'm leaving. And that's it. It just drives me crazy, because the public thinks that's how it works, and it really isn't. It's really a craft. You know, you really got to be real skillful in the way you deal with these people. Be it the one time, what we think of as the one time, you know, guy who's kidnapped a kid off the street or broken into the house and molested the child, you know. It's not their first time, trust me. It may be the first time they got caught, but it ain't their first time. And so they got all the behaviors of a long-time, lifetime sex offender. And so you just need to play them that way. You know, it's just, you know, like narcs understand how to talk narc talk with the dopers and stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The sex crimes guys need to learn their business and know how to talk sex offender talk, and just play them that way. You don't want to be real accusatory and tell them that they're bad and evil and awful, but you want them to explain their behavior, which they oftentimes would really love to do. Or they'll just lie their butts off. And if they lie and lie and lie, a lie is better than a confession sometimes, you know.
Right.
When you can say, oh, I never know, it was never even in your city, then you put their DNA, you know, Dr. Jan collects the DNA during the rape exam, and you go, oh, I gotcha, you know, that kind of stuff. So either way, it works for us as soon as they start talking.
Okay.
I had one guy tell me the one time that we did it, we had DNA, and he wasn't in town. He told me that it was no way possible, that it was a fairy that brought it.
A fairy?
A fairy, yeah, there you go. Like the stork story, I like that one. Yeah. And these guys are real ingenious in some of their lies, don't get me wrong. They're really pretty creative sometimes, which makes it interesting. And the more they say stuff like that, you know, the better it is. I just let them keep talking. You know, explain the fairy. How tall was the fairy? You know, what color was the fairy? Because the more they lie, the more they're going to prison, you know.
Probably the worst thing would be the suspect who just says, I'm going to remain silent.
Right, right.
Because then you get nothing. I mean, you have no lies or anything. I certainly can see where a lie is better than nothing, and sometimes better than the actual confession. Don, dealing with the kids now, back to the victim, or the alleged victim, what do you find, there's a lot of thought out there that, well, when you're dealing with a 3-, 4-, 5-year-old and so forth, they're not very good witnesses, they can't be trusted, blah, blah, blah. What's your feeling, or how would you answer those comments?
Well, it's one of those that's true and false. You know, little kids don't have any predilections or prejudices about how the world works. So they're oftentimes are very truthful and just blurt out anything. You know, the Art Linkletter show years ago was, you know, kids will say the darndest things, and it's usually the truth. They'll just blurt out stuff. And that's which is pretty good. But the problem you have with them is that they will also accept things to be true that they really don't understand is true, such as, did Santa Claus leave presents under the Christmas tree last night? And they will tell you, yes, that Santa Claus did that, but they really don't know it. And this is a problem for us when we have custody disputes where, you know, one parent is alleging a molest during last weekend's visitation kind of a thing. And the kid can be convinced that there was a touching of some sort just based on the fact that they accept what mom and dad tell them. And so it's not a matter of the kids actually lying, because lying implies an intent to deceive or to gain something. And little kids don't have that ability. But they can be convinced that something happened when it really did not. So your interview style with the kids has to take that into account and have some sort of test system to see if they're being accurate or not.
Okay, we have a caller. Let's from the 813 area code. 813, you're on the line. Go ahead, please.
Thank you. This is for both of the panelists, and I appreciate you taking my call. I'd like to know how old the youngest victim that you've been associated with was. And the second question is, do you find much more family molestation than you do stranger kind of molestation? It seems to me that parents are willing to accept some kind of stranger touched my child, but much less willing to accept that, you know, it's somebody that I live with or somebody that I love.
Right. Dr. Jan, you want to go first? You want me to?
Sure. My youngest patient was 6 months old, and there was a severe rectal tearing and vaginal tearing, and it was pretty bad. I mean, I know I'm not supposed to get involved, but it's pretty hard to get involved when you have a 6-month-old that comes in, and there's no reason for it, you know. And it was happened to be the father, and the father was explaining to the police officer that the baby had pooped, and he was just cleaning the anal area really well. But it was more than that, because she was very torn up inside. So I don't know about you.
Well, we've had some that are several days old, you know, where some sort of abuse has happened. We either have photographs of it, or, like I say, the kid shows up at the ER room with some sort of bleeding or injury or something such as that. And in physical abuse cases also, you get them, you know, several days old. They're being beaten half to death by mom or dad. And to answer the other question is about in-family versus stranger. Oh, yeah, in-family is hundreds of thousands more times more prevalent than stranger stuff. If you think about it, the news media only reports things that are unusual and rare, and that's why they report the stranger kidnapping once and that kind of stuff. The in-family stuff is so common that they don't even want to deal with it. It's everyday stuff, and so most of my business is in-family stuff or someone in a position of trust.
Do things come to both of you because someone has noticed something physical with the child, or is it usually they've told somebody something at school, or how do these things usually manifest themselves to you?
In my case, it comes from the police department or the child and family services lets me know, and that's how I get my information. Nobody just really walks off the street where I'm at and tells me anything like that. That's how I get my resources. They usually don't go to private practice. Pediatricians' offices might, but I don't get them unless they come in from the police or children and family services.
Right. From my experience, a straight a medical exam of a 2 or 3 year old usually doesn't involve any sort of pelvic examination, you know. And so for a routine pediatrician to find something just on their own is very, very rare. But the kid has to tell somebody somehow. Maybe another kid is usually what they do. They trust children more than they do adults, or they'll tell somebody who will. The common disclosure pattern is they tell a friend at school, that friend tells the teacher tells the school nurse tells the vice principal, who tells the school nurse to call the police. That's usually how it goes. That's why by Friday we have to wait till Monday to go talk to them.
Right.
It's a few days for that to happen.
Okay, well, thank you very much for taking my questions. I appreciate it.
All right, thanks for calling.
Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Okay, let's go back now to our case that has progressed nicely to this point. And actually, let's say the suspect does not confess.
Okay.
And we actually go to court.
Right.
How well do children tend to hold up, let's say under 10 or under 8 or whatever, young children, tend to hold up once they actually have to get into the courtroom setting and be subject to that whole scene and the examination, the direct and the cross and all that? Are they fairly durable, or do you lose a lot of cases in that when you get to that setting?
My experience has been they're pretty good, that they do pretty well. In the courtrooms where I work, the kids are all brought in a week ahead of time by someone in victim witness who takes them into the courtroom. They let them sit in the judge's chair. They sit in the witness stand. They do a little mock trial. They tell them how much fun it's going to be. They can have the victim advocate actually sit up there at the witness stand with them to just be there for moral support, that kind of stuff. And they usually do really well. The defense lawyers are real reluctant to be their abrasive selves, as we all know they can be, with a child, because it turns the jury off. And so the questioning really isn't as difficult or abrasive or combative as it might be with an adult victim.
I don't know about you, Dan, but when I have testified in my medical findings, I have also know that the juries do tend to believe the child a little more than they would believe the adult.
Oh, absolutely, the kids come across really well most of the time. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we had one where the girl was actually kidnapped out of her house. She was 11, driven off into the wilderness, and one of the worst vaginal traumas our medical staff had ever seen, and a stranger rape kind of a thing. And we had all this physical evidence. We put the girl on. She testified for about 2 hours, and we put on 2 weeks of other evidence, and the jury came back guilty and all that. And we asked the jury afterwards, what decided you, what was it that made you think he was guilty? She goes, as soon as the girl told us what happened and pointed at the guy, said everything else was interesting, but we'd already decided the first day. We were done. 2 hours, we could have been out the door by now, and we believed the girl. So we're going, okay, whatever, And so it's something to think about. Well, maybe we shouldn't have put all that stuff on, but you don't want to not to, of course. But they're pretty believable. We weed out all the custody disputes and all the bad ones. We weed those out way before we get to trial. And so the kids usually do pretty well. Another unique thing about younger kids, and Dr. Jan, you might want to talk about this too, they're real concrete thinkers. And so
yep.
We've had situations where we used to use anatomically correct dolls which we don't do anymore, but we had all the naked dolls on the witness stand and asked the little girl who was about six to use one of the dolls, to use the dolls and show us what happened. And so she picks up a male adult doll, stands up on the chair, faces the jury, pulls up her dress, and starts to rub the doll on her underwear, which was a very unique description of what had happened to her, but wasn't quite what we had wanted her to do. You know, we actually wanted her to use the dolls to show what the guy had done to her. But in her concrete thinking mind, that's exactly what we had asked her. So so your prosecutor has to be real careful in the way they phrase questions to little kids. And Dr. Jan, you probably had the same thing, where kids are really pretty open about what's going on with them, you know?
Yeah, very.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's amazing. It just amazes me. And we don't give them much credit, you know? We just think they're little and they don't know what they're talking about, but, you know, they can surprise you.
There's a case that's, well, it hasn't been in the news so much in the last few weeks, but made quite a splash when it happened, was the California case with Sandra Cantu. And that's a young girl that was allegedly kidnapped and raped by a neighbor who was a female Sunday school teacher. And that, I believe, is a rarity. I mean, generally when I hear about a molestation or a family or a stranger involved, I think of somebody with a rap sheet about 3 miles long and
right.
almost a mental image of what, you know, the scumbag look or something. How rare is it to have a female charged with a female victim and then somebody who's a Sunday school teacher? Is that pretty unique?
It's a real rare one to me. To get a female offender who strikes out with any level of violence is real rare. You may have the school teacher who's having sex with the, you know, fifth grade boys or something such as that, and you have this sort of seduction, you know, sexual preference kind of thing going on. But to have someone who's actually an anger or power rapist as a female who is drugging or kidnapping or, you know, using a level of force to sexually assault anybody, male or female, well, that's a rare one. That's like winning the lottery on that one, you know. And what you have to look at it is it's the same power and control issues you'd have with a male suspect. It's just that you usually just don't see it in women. You know, and like I say, I don't have any insights on that case other than what the news media said, but it's a strange one. You know, it's a real rare one, but, you know, doesn't mean it can't happen, obviously.
Yeah, Dr. Kent, have you had any experience with that?
No, actually, to tell you the truth, in my whole entire time, I have never had that. And I had them abuse, women abuse them, but I've, you know, beat them or what, you know, but I've never had them sexually assault anybody.
Yeah, I've had several cases involving women as suspects, and they're seducing, you know, the neighbor boy or their teachers, and you know, molesting, you know, the fifth grader, sixth grader, that kind of stuff. And you see the same sort of power control issues you do with your basic power rapist. You know, they're using their position of trust, they're using their position of authority to gain something. The psychologists will tell you that the underlying motivation is different, but the behavior is pretty much the same, and that's all I deal with is behavior. And and let the psychologist figure out the why part of it, you know. But women have a tendency to internalize their narcissistic kind of behaviors and become victims themselves by marrying into a bad family, have the husband who beats them up, that kind of stuff, where men have a tendency to change, to take all their anxieties and frustrations and turn them into anger and then project them towards somebody else, such as I'll go make somebody else feel worse than I am by kidnapping and raping, that kind of stuff. But to get a woman to take on that role is very, very rare in my experience.
Yeah.
Do you, Don, have you encountered many cases of where you have the molestation occurring by a family member or, you know, a live-in boyfriend type thing, where the mother, say, was aware of it and just did nothing or should have been aware of it and didn't do anything?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. We've had them actually walk in on dad having intercourse with the girls, and she'll excuse herself and say, "Oh, sorry, I'm interrupted you," that kind of stuff.
God.
I mean, really, it's that bad. Where the kid is saying, you know, daddy's touching me, and they say, "Well, you know, just tell him to stop. He's just showing him that he loves you." But he's having intercourse with them. They're four or five.
Or they, or they blame them for taking their man away.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
They say, well, you know, you're walking around with those, you know, short shorts and, you know, the midriff tops and, you know, you walk around and you're enticing him and it's all your fault.
Oh,
I've had that.
Yeah, that's real common, too, where the whole family will turn their back on the child. How dare you have seduced my husband and you're just whatever, and it's all the kid's fault. And there are some of these kids like 8, 9 years old, and you're going, how come they become sexualized like that? And all you have is a mom who's not plugged into the kid at all, what's going on in the family at all, and is really an absentee parent. But, yeah, we've had that quite a bit where they've actually seen the molest or the kid's telling them about the molest or they found the photographs of the husband molesting the kid. And oftentimes they'll choose the husband over the child when it comes down to, you know, which one do I want to choose, have my daughter or have my husband.
Because they don't want to lose that, they don't want to lose his support, and, you know, because 9 times out of 10 they're supporting her, they have the house, they don't want to be on the streets, so that's why they'll go with that.
Right, they'll do that, and I think there's got to be some, you know, some other psychological issues going on there that I really don't understand. Where it's so obvious that the child has been molested, but they pick the husband, or and it's not even the, you know, it's maybe like their third or fourth husband. It's not like they're not used to being divorced, you know, but they'll still stick with him for some reason. I don't know how to explain that one.
Let me ask you this now: in a case that's very blatant, like if you know somebody comes in and catches their male. Husband or boyfriend, whatever, having intercourse with the child, and they say, oh, excuse me, I realize that's probably extreme, but when they admit or can be proved that they were aware and failed to take action, are they ever charged anything, neglect or endangerment or that type of thing?
In California, it gets real difficult to do that because, you know, if they fail to take action, you have to say, were they legally obligated to take action? Where, like, you and I as police officers are obligated to take action, we're obligated to report. And are they truly obligated under law to take steps to prevent the molest? And is the molest, if you want to file on them for something like a felony child endangering, you have to establish that the molest is likely to cause great bodily injury or psychological harm, which is difficult to do in a courtroom. You know, everybody common sense-wise tells you, well, yeah, of course. But from a proving it up kind of point of view, it's always kind of difficult, and what we try to do is schmooze them into testifying against the bad guy, you know, the husband, versus something bad happened to him. And then the times I've been able to prosecute them is for perjury. It's when they get up on the witness stand and change their story and say, no, nothing happened, I never saw nothing, that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then the perjury is really an easier, from a legal point of view, to prove up than any sort of contributing to the delinquency of or a co-conspirator or something such as that. You know, we have had cases where the mom is you know, delivered the kids to the dad knowing that the molest is going to happen. You can do like a co-conspirator, a rape in concert kind of a case. But just knowledge and failing to act is a really tough one, in California at least, to prosecute.
Wow. It's frustrating, I think, to a lot of people who feel that these mothers who, especially, and it's been on recently too, some of these abductions or disappearances is where the mothers know that they're male friend, you know, is a convicted sex offender and that type of thing,
right.
And they choose to place the child in that environment by having this guy in the house, and they seem to get away with it. I know I've heard and read a lot of blogs in various places that people are very frustrated, thinking that the mother should bear some of the burden, you know, for placing the child in that type of situation.
Oh, absolutely, Danny. Nothing frustrates me more than talk to a mom who herself was molested by her father, and then she takes her children over to visit Grandpa for the weekend, and then comes back and is surprised. Oh, my God, he molested the kid, too. And we're going, oh, duh, McFly. What did you think? You know. And then the guy goes to jail. He comes back, and they take the kid over again. And we're going, what is with this? You know. And I don't know, you know, what the psychology is. Maybe Dr. Jan knows a little bit better, but I don't. It doesn't make any sense to me at all, but we see it over and over and over again.
It's basically, it's because, in my opinion, I just believe, you know, if the mother was molested, that's all she knew.
Right.
And since nobody helped her, her thinking is, you know, why should I help her? You know, it's basically a pattern that forms.
My thought has always been, if they've never dealt with their own victimization, then they can't see it in somebody else. They still have the blinders on, and they just can't or won't see it. That's sort of a layman's way of looking at it. I don't know, maybe that's accurate or not. You can come.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah.
And like I say, we see it, you know, these historical molests where grandpa's molested everybody in the family, you know, the kids, the grandkids, the nieces, the nephews, blah, 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 blah. And we got like 50, 60 victims when we get into these cases, and we're going, somebody had to know. You know, how come we got this finally, the 5-year-old tells somebody at school, and it's been going on for 50 years? And we're going, why is that? I mean, it just drives me crazy.
Oh, God. What I'd like to do, if we could, with the last 14 or minutes or so we have left, is to get away from the child crimes against children and move on to adults.
Okay.
Rape, sexual abuse of adults. We were talking a minute ago about how some, in some cases, the mothers blame the kids. Or, you know, the you were asking for it type thing. You shouldn't have been wearing that short nightgown, you know, when you were here alone with a boyfriend or that type of thing. I remember that used to be one of the things for an adult rape case was they were asking for it. You know, they were out dressed seductively and hanging out in the wrong places and so on and so forth. I think, generally accepted that in a lot of cases the victim, if you end up in court, unlike maybe the children who the jury might be annoyed with the defense attorney attacking or being mean, if you will, to a child witness, would be less sympathetic to the adult victim. Is that really a problem today, that perhaps the victim's conduct led to the offense?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It's a big, giant one for us. We get the girls who are engaging in what we call high-risk behaviors because they're 17, 18, 19, 20, 20, whatever years old, and they do high-risk things. They go out with strangers. They get have too much to drink at a party. They pass out in the upstairs bedroom, and next thing you know, somebody comes up and is having sex with them. Because, well, they were passed out, and sure, they're in bed, so why not, that kind of stuff. There's a lot of their behaviors that a good defense lawyer can take us down the road of potential consent as opposed to a rape. And it's my job to kind of get past that, because I'll actually use that as an entry line to the interview. You know, tell us how we ended up with this woman kind of thing. And he'll say, well, you know, I met her at the party, blah, 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 that kind of stuff. And you know, he says, I did have intercourse with her, but you know, well, she was passed out at the time, that kind of stuff, you know. But, yeah, it is a real difficult one when we get girls who just, like I said, put themselves out there, and it's difficult for us to pull it back and say, yeah, that was actually rape as opposed to something you did while intoxicated that you would not have done had you been sober. And you know, we're always making that decision there.
Or if they were under GHB and then, you know.
GHB's a big one. All the rehypnols, alcohol, of course, is the big one, you know. It's real difficult for us to say, you know, did they get drunk to the point they did something, they consented to do something they don't remember, or were they truly passed out and unaware and unable to give consent? That's a real tough one for us, yeah.
And that's what I find, that being when they come into the ER that way, and, you know, that's why they don't want to contact the police, because they figure, well, I went with him and we were drinking and, you know, and I'm just going to be raked through the mud, so they don't even want to bother, which is pretty sad. I mean, if a woman is unconscious and you got to have sex with her, there's a problem, you know.
Yeah, and what we have, the issue is that, you know, a boy, maybe girl, and they're at a party or the club or whatever, and there may be a certain level of consensual touching, you know, kissing, you know, petting, whatever, and the girl says, okay, I'm gone as far as I'm willing to go right now because I just met the guy, and the guy takes it further. And because they're intoxicated or fear or whatever, they don't actively resist as much as we'd like to see. It's real difficult for a jury to be able to draw the line when stop should have been stop, you know, unless the girl actively fights and resists and that kind of stuff, which a lot of times they're not willing to do because they've been told not to. And we end up with what we think behaviorally is a really good rape, but we can't prove up the force element. And that's still, but Danny, your question is very valid. It's still a problem for us in court. It's a real big problem.
So, it's almost the reverse of what some people think. I was mentioning earlier that a lot of people think kids would be terrible witnesses and blah, blah, blah.
Right.
But the adult victim, of course, depending on each individual case, but could have a lot of baggage.
Oh, absolutely. We got them, you know, I danced naked on the pool table in front of the whole party, and then I passed out in the bedroom and someone raped me. Okay, and which actually happens. They are legitimate rapes, but it's difficult to convince a jury of that. You know,
exactly.
And one of the classics was this girl was hitchhiking, got picked up by two guys. They go out in the bushes and to drink and whatever, and the one guy kept coming on to the girl, and his friend says, leave her alone. Ultimately, there's a rape where the suspect rapes this woman and is rescued by his friend. You know, he comes over and he actually gets in a fist fight with the suspect and says, leave her alone, you're raping her. And he gets beat up and everybody's beat up, blah, blah, blah. And the girl had her jaw broken, her eyes swollen closed. And we went to trial on that, and the suspect's friend said, no, he was raping her. She was saying, no, he was raping her. The jury still came back not guilty.
Aye, aye, aye.
Thinking that, she went out there drinking with him, so he had an expectation of having intercourse with her. And we're going, okay, how does that happen when her eyes swollen closed?
Yeah.
And the witness said, no, it was not rape. You know, we lose those every now and then, and it's real frustrating for us, obviously.
Well, sure. Gee, that would sound like a strong...
Yeah.
When you got the guy's buddy.
Absolutely. But again, the behavior of her going out to drink with strangers, basically, the jury just didn't like that, you know. And
wow.
So I don't know how to explain it, you know.
Yeah, it's very unnerving, I guess. Well, you know, the old you're asking for a trick, I guess, if you didn't...
But, and we still have that. That's why we have March is Rape Awareness Month. We have Denim Day. What was it? Dr. Jan was the judge in Italy, set a rape case aside because he didn't think a woman who was wearing jeans could be raped because of the difficulty of getting the jeans off. And so now we have Denim Day to protest that.
You know, oh, wow.
Yeah, because if you look at the dynamics of a rape, what happens is there's the approach, contact, and capture of the victim. Once the victim is psychologically captured, she will comply in order to get the guy done and out of there. And so she will remove her clothes. She'll do whatever. She won't actively resist it to the level that we think they should. But because they're captured and they're in this, you know, almost a Stockholm Syndrome kind of a thing, I'll do whatever to get the guy out of here before he kills me. They'll oftentimes do things that look like consent that are really just survival.
Yep.
And it's real difficult to prove that up in court sometimes, especially if they're not real... they're not real verbal, you know. They're not real educated. They can't express themselves very well. It gets real difficult for us to do that, and we just have to wait for the bad guy to offend again and then go after him the second time.
Well, I had a case when I was a police officer where there was a lady who was going to be raped, and she went along with it. You know, she told the guy, "Go ahead, get undressed, and we'll do it."
Uh-huh.
And then what she did is she had a pair of vice grips and she grabbed his testicles and clamped them and made them come along. Till she went to the till she got the police to come,
right.
And then she said this guy tried to rape me, and he couldn't say much because she had him behind the ball.
Yeah,
but that's how she did it.
Right, and I think we've all had those really ones where we go, yeah, rape for the victim. You know, the one where the suspect at knife point was raping this 14-year-old, and she was able to push him to the side of the bed and say, hold on for a second. She picks the knife up off the floor and stabs him with it. You know, I thought that was pretty cool. But we don't get those very often. We always like to point to them and go, yay, success story. But the rape trauma stuff is so overpowering. It's such a psychological control that it's hard for women to think their way out of it or fight their way out of the scenario, which makes it difficult for us in court.
You get a lot of date rape allegations?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, tons of them, yeah. Yeah, and some of them, you know, we do get lots of false reports. We couldn't have to do this show without talking about false reports. You know, I broke curfew because I was raped, or I woke up with the wrong guy. My husband's going to be upset. You know, whatever. You know, we get tons of those, and behaviorally, those kind of stand out when you look at them. When through the victim interview, you look at it, go, we don't have any suspect behavior here that matches any of the known rapists that we know of. And those kind of jump out at you after you've done this job for a decade or so. But we do get a lot of date rapes where guys are legitimately looking for girls who've had too much to drink at the nightclub or the party or the wherever, where they are actually, you know, stalking them. But their level of force is real minimal because they're not the type who are going to kidnap somebody out of the mall parking lot, but they'll
mm-hmm.
find somebody who's about to pass out and then grab them because their force level is real low. Those are, we see a lot of what we call date rape, yeah.
And those are probably, the, you know, these conduct of the victim comes into play, and were they, you know, acting or dancing seductively with the guy, and all that. I imagine all that comes into play then, that it wasn't.
Right, right. The victim's behavior is bites us in the butt a lot of the time, because I'll look at it behaviorally and say, yeah, this is behaviorally a rape, or behaviorally it's not. But a lot of times, yeah, behaviorally this is a rape, this is a rapist. But unless I can get multiple victims to say, yeah, he's done the same thing to me, on a one-on-one, it's real tough. It's real, real tough to get a jury to believe it. And so we do a lot. My job is to do a lot of research and see if the guy's got a whole history of this. We can find these other uncharged victims and put them all together and maybe make a case that way.
Do you find that, Dr. Jane, if you're examining an adult rape victim or alleged rape victim, do they have a dialogue with you, or try to get a dialogue explaining what happened and that type of thing, or they tend just
yeah.
to put, yeah.
And I find when they, I'm not saying, you know, until you can get all the information, but I find when they talk a lot, that means nothing really happened. It's the ones that are very quiet and reserved, and you know, are like curled up in a ball, that are just traumatized.
Right.
You know, take it seriously. But the ones that, yep, you know, a lot of times it's the alcohol, and they're claiming this, and they just yep, you know, and you don't see any force, you know, because
right.
there's no, you know, redness or anything like that, or they go home and take a shower, and, you know, it's pretty bad, especially when they drink. You know, they don't understand. They drink this alcohol when it's free, but they don't realize the consequences when they drink it. You know, their body weight and how much and how fast they get drunk, and you know, the problems they get into. You know, that's
right.
What I have found.
Right, and again, there are no absolutes, but we see the same thing where you get in this monotone, flatline kind of a behavior by the legitimate victim. It's like Danny and I were talking earlier about the officer who's been involved in the on-duty shooting, where he's got the "I'm okay, fine" mentality. He's just perfectly flat line. He's trying to control the psychological impact as much as he can. Rape victims do the same thing. They try to control it. It's like they're trying to hold it in a little box in their brain, and that's where their effort is designed at. And we do talk to them. They're kind of flat line. They're kind of one-word responses. You know, they'll tell you what's happening with no emotion at all. And Dr. Jan, you probably see that a lot. Where they look like, sometimes cops will get fooled by that. They'll say, "This victim's so emotionless, she must be lying." I'm going, no, that's what you want to see. It's the ones who are chatty Cathy's and laughing and giggling, that, you know, like Dr. Chan was saying, that you just go, yeah, right, you know. Those aren't legitimate to me. But
now, we got a couple of minutes left, and I'd like to get both of your opinions on this. Obviously, each jurisdiction, each state has its own sentencing requirements and so forth, and parole issues and so on. But sometimes when you read or hear about these cases where you say, geez, the alleged perpetrator was actually just released from prison. He just did, you know, like 1 year for a rape or a molestation or what have you. And how could this guy be back on the streets? Generally speaking, do you think the criminal justice system adequately protects the citizens by when they deal with the defendant or with the convicted defendant? Or in some areas, are we too lenient and let people who still pose a danger back out on the streets with access to the children or to victims?
My experience has been, when a guy gets like a really light sentence, a year or two for something he should have gotten like 200 years for, you know, that's
mm-hmm.
usually a plea deal you have to make because the victim won't testify, or you can't get him into court, or you got evidence issues or something like that. And so the district attorney's office is forced to make a deal just to get the conviction, as opposed to letting him walk altogether. And that's why
okay.
they're getting out so early. If you have a really good case, and it's my job to build a case that's so good the guy has to plead guilty, but in California, at least, sex offenders, you know, we're slamming them. Anything under 40 or 50 years, I don't even take credit for anymore. You know, if we're not getting into the hundreds with them, and it's kind of
right.
like, you know, like a, not a big deal for us anymore. So if you have a good case and you got a victim you can keep together to go to court, and the evidence, like Jan gets, then yeah, we'll slam them pretty hard. I mean, we get them to plead to 100 years to life kind of routinely here. But again, when you get a real low sentence, it's usually because there's some trial issue or something going on.
And the other thing, too, is I don't know if you experienced it in California, but I knew when I worked the jail in Chicago, it was overcrowding.
Right.
And they took, you know, they let the people go that, you know, I know they were, they're a menace to society, but they let the less ones out because of the overcrowding. We need to get more jails built instead of closing them. You know, we have to have funding for that because it's just getting ridiculous.
Well, I'd agree. In California, they're trying to, anybody who wants to become governor or wants to become the district attorney is always making a push for stronger laws against sex offenders, but they don't follow up with, we need prisons to put them in. You know, and so we, it doesn't make any difference to send a guy to prison for 200 years if you don't have a cell to put him in, you know.
And not even that, you don't even have the money. The state is going broke. They don't even have the money to get the personnel to put him in, you know.
Right.
So it's, you know, that's the whole problem. And until we can get the law enforcement can get the funding and, you know, because there's police departments that are closing even. You know, I know friends back home that in small towns that are using their own money for gas because the town is so poor for their squad cars. So until we can get law enforcement to get funded, you know, they can talk all they want about how they're going to help crime, but we have to get the money.
Guys, I hate to say this, that we run over our time limit here. I don't know where it went to. It went quick. But I want to, Don, thank you so much for being on. I really appreciate it. Maybe we can get you to come back again sometime.
Well, I'd love to, Danny. I appreciate it. I really appreciate you having me on.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. And Dr. Jan, thanks a lot for being on.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Okay. You guys have a great night, and thanks again.
All right. Thank you, Danny.
And good night, everybody, and thanks for listening. And we'll catch you in 2 weeks on the next Juror 13 show. Thanks and good night.